asking you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At the time we begin the TechNet. TechNet number 1586 of the series that began in 1982, September. The main purpose of the TechNet is education. The amateurs come together and teach each other how to use their equipment and how to use it better, how to get more performance out of it. We have a sort of a loose schedule we follow. Of the first hour, we take questions and comments from people who have general questions of a ham radio nature. It's followed by John, KC2WGB, who reads the mailbag for those who don't yet have their ham license or the right equipment to talk to us directly. John also monitors the echo link so that if we don't leave the right pauses so that you're not getting a chance to sign in with echo link, John knows about it. He also monitors the chat room so you can leave messages with him as to whether or not you were able to get your itch and work wise, if you know what I mean. After the mailbag, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, tells us the latest on what National Aeronautics and Space Administration, as well as the other foreign space agencies, what they're doing. Let me drop. And along the way, we quite often hear from Hal, K6DPZ, who's got a lot of experience with lots of kinds of electronics, and he claims to give the more brief answers to my more verbose answers. So in some cases, you get both kinds of answers. Listen to the one you care about. The TechNet is backed up by at least two websites, as well as Echo Link and IRLP. There are people listening from quite a few states, quite a few countries. One of the websites that gives you backup information for the TechNet is Mike Number One, Mike Perry, KC2NJI. That website is www.amateurradio.tangovictor. You go there and you'll see the last 10 years of TechNets. Quite a few thousand hours worth of them recorded. You choose the right year, the right month, the right week. Download the TechNet information in 1 hour reels. And there's either four or five reels there for each individual week for the last 10 weeks. The last 10 years. Let me drop. Because the TechNet starts at 8 o'clock on Sunday nights, for most of the last 33 years, and goes till midnight, that's 4 hours worth, not everybody can stay up that late, they gotta go to work the next day. So, you wait about 3 or 4 days from the particular TechNet that just took place. That recording of that net will appear on that website, and you can download it and listen to it as you commute or on your lunch hour and so on, and there are a fair number of people who do that. The other website that supports the TechNet is Mike Number Two, K1MJM, and that's at Limarctechnet.com. I'll eventually get it right. Limarctechnet.com with a www in front of that. And there you'll find supporting information, meaning articles, pictures, graphs, S-parameter information. Let's see, a Smith chart, all kinds of things like that, backing up the TechNet. So Mike Number One, Mike Number Two are our online our website supporters. Let me drop. Now, I presume you guys got some snow this weekend. So whether or not that affected your antennas, whether or not a buddy of mine called me up and said, is the snow halfway up my tower? Did that much snow fall in New York? This is a guy who lives in Texas. He's a slight exaggerator. But I moved close to 4,000 cubic feet of snow today with my snowblower. And a fairly heroic effort from my point of view. Well, quite a bit more exercise than I normally get. Imagine you guys have gotten some snow. In Dix Hills, Huntington, I think I got around 23, 24 inches. The adjacent town to me in Comac got something like 28 inches of snow. Okay, give me your call letters and name right now if you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, KC2WG. one, then yes. So, give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW listening.
Name is Joe. Question, yes.
Okay, I heard Joe. Question that. Joe, give me your full call letters.
Whiskey Bravo 2, Hotel Radio Oscar.
Okay, Whiskey Bravo 2, Hotel Radio Oscar, Joe. All right, there was a double there. Who was the other person signing in at that time?
2PYT, Ed, yes.
Okay, we've got Ed, PYT. So far we got Joe and Ed. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, Paul, I heard you on the input, but I didn't hear you coming through the machine. Maybe your PO is not turned on. But I heard you on the 8-5 input. Okay, we got Joe and Ed so far. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WB2HRO, am I making it over the interference, over?
You sound loud and clear, go right ahead, Joe.
Okay, my question is, and I'm trying to get this worked out, I want to make 600 ohm open wire line, I want to make my own. I have miles of 18 branded insulated wire. I'd like to, as I say, find out what the proper spacing is. I know the thinner the wire, the closer the wire should be to each other. So, you know, there's a company that makes an open line that's 600 ohms and it's 16 gauge wire, but their dimensions would not do for me. I'd wonder if there's any way of figuring out, or anybody knows the formula by which one could find it out, and if they could do that for me. Back to you. Over.
Yeah, it turns out that the diameter of the wire is a secondary effect. The spacing between the wire is the main thing, Joe. If you went from fairly thick wire to fairly thin wire and properly adjusted the spacing, the change in spacing would be rather small by comparison. You double the diameter of the wire, you'd absolutely do not double the distance, if you know what I mean. On top of that, if you get the spacing wrong, make the spacing a little bit too large, your 600 ohm line will be 650 ohm line. Make the spacing too small and your 600 ohm line will be 500 ohm line. And there's nothing magic about 600 ohm line. As long as it is compatible with the rest of your system, with whatever you're using as a balancing device to take your 50 ohm coax cable and a half wave coax balun, or there's various kinds of balancing devices you can buy that will do the impedance step up from unbalanced coax cable to balanced open wire line, 300 ohm, 450, 600, and so on. The magic of open wire line, let me drop. The magic of open wire line is that at HF frequencies, up to 30 megacycles, so to speak, it has extremely low loss. Therefore, you could be operating an antenna connected to open wire line, where the antenna has, let me pick a number, a 30-to-1 standing wave ratio. And when you're feeding with this very low-loss open wire line, you might have an extra half a dB of loss. You take that exact same standing wave ratio and use 50-ohm coax cable, and you're going to get 15 dB of loss instead of a half a dB of loss, if you know what I mean. Coax cable is not very forgiving of extremely high standing wave ratio. Open wire line will take an extremely high standing wave ratio and simply laugh at it, if you know what I mean. Keep right on cranking. So it's got a lot of desirable characteristics. The only undesirable characteristic is that you don't want to lay open wire line up against metallic structures. It's a little bit troublesome to feed it through the wall of the house. In fact, some people will feed coax cable through the wall of the house and then convert over to the open wire line on the outside of the house. The open wire line, you can't take multiple turns of it and lay it against each other. You could lay it against the ground for a very short distance, but I don't recommend that. nearly as expensive. Let me drop it. It's a very inexpensive transmission line. Very low in insertion loss. Great for home brewing. So as you can see, it's got a lot of things going for it, Joe. Therefore, worth pursuing. If you take a look at the Radio Amateur's Handbook, you'll find a formula on diameter of wire, spacing of wire, in order to make 600 ohm open wire line. Reference data for radio engineers has the formula. Guarantee you can Google, there's got to be 10 or 15 different websites you can Google which will tell you the specifics of open wire line. Just by Googling the word open wire line, you're going to find a lot of information. I vaguely remember formula is something like 176 multiplied by the log of A over B, where A is the diameter of the wire and B is the spacing. I might have that wrong. The formula looks something like that. And so, and by way of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, or just by, again by Googling open wire line, you'll find various ways that people have home brewed it, where the spacers were made out of wood, sometimes ice cream sticks, pieces of plastic, pieces of PVC pipe. People have used all kinds of things for the spacers for homebrew open wire line. And the exact diameter of the wire you use is not as critical. It's not as critical as you think. Now, I think we probably have a couple of people listening who have used open wire line in the past. As such, drag your feet a little bit when I send it back to you and see if anyone else is going to give us some further information on their experience with open wire line. WB2HRO, a little bit of a delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the TechNet. This is K6 Delta Papa Zulu. Hello, Dick. You want some information about ladder line? I'm ready to talk.
Yeah, I'll bet you've used open wire line, ladder line, a lot in your life. You probably have burned in your mind the formula, and you probably have a recommended method of construction. So go right ahead, Al. K6 DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, first of all, you can make all sorts of ladder line, and I'm just going to explain how you can measure the impedance of what piece of ladder line you make. So, you know, you can take your spacers, you can use cigar, popsicle sticks, anything. You can even use twin lead if you really want to, or a 110-volt AC cord will work. To measure the impedance, make up a length of ladder line. Take a carbon pot, 1,500 ohms, tie it on one end, and take a grid dip meter and tie it on the other end with a loop. Run that grid dip meter from 100 megahertz all the way down. You're going to see a bunch of dips. Adjust the pot until you see no dips when you go through all the frequency spread. Then take that little pot out and measure the DC resistance of the pot. That is the impedance of the electric.
Okay, that sounds like a handy technique for measuring the impedance by putting a variable load resistor, a potentiometer, a 1500 ohm resistor. There's nothing magic about 1500 ohms. It could be a 2000 ohm, a 1000 ohm, and so on, just as long as it's going to cover your particular region. And so you adjust that potentiometer so that with a loop of wire at the other end of the open wire line, and you're sweeping it with your grid dip meter. If you no longer see dips, if it looks like it has no resonance at all, what that really means is that if your line happened to be 631 ohms, for instance, because of its particular spacing, and once you adjust your potentiometer at the far end at 631 ohms, all the signal coming from the grid dip meter picked up by that loop at one end, all that signal going down the open wire line says, hey, I'm 631 ohm open wire line. There's a perfect 631 ohm resistor at the far end. All the power goes down that line once, hits the resistor, every bit of it gets absorbed. There's no longer any reflection, therefore there's no resonance. Whereas if the pot is too low in resistance or too high in resistance, some amount of signal will reflect because there's an impedance mismatch between the open wire line and the pot, and therefore you'll see those resonances. That's a pretty nice way, Hal, for measuring the exact impedance. Now, the exact impedance, as I said earlier, let me drop.
Hot deck, remember that. Not wire wound.
got to make sure it's a non-wire wound pot. And so wire wound pots are pretty... wire wound pots are pretty rare, so I don't think people's going to run into that one very often. And there's nothing magic about 600 ohms. If your line turns out to be 631, it'll work equally as well as if it was 590, if you know what I mean. So this is an academic test. Other methods of constructing open wire line that you have seen over the years, give us a couple of handy, crafty techniques that people have used. Ice cream sticks, pieces of PVC tubing, pieces of plexiglass, all kinds of insulating materials have been used for open wire line, and the method by which you bind the line to the end of your spacers. I bet you've seen some pretty crafty techniques there also. So give us a couple of those, Hal. C6DPZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
WTechNet station, CPZ, southbound on the Van Vick Expressway. Pill bottles. Throw in and buy plastic pill bottles and drill holes from the pill bottles. Now put them together and it's a spacer and they work as beautiful spacers for ladder line, fake ladder line. Also, everything is insulated. Your insulators for making up your ladder line. You want to use during the day, use cardboard. Make up cardboard tubes. All cardboard tubes, put holes through them. You got ladder lines. Go ahead, Jeff.
Almost any, what Hal is telling us is that almost any insulating device, pill bottles, pieces of cardboard, well, you'd have to weatherproof it in some manner. Slats of wood. Let me think now. The pieces of wood that people use for making the so-called cheap Yagis of WA5EJB, those slats of wood, molding like things. If you walk up and down your hardware store, your Home Depot store, you'll see all kinds of insulating materials you can cut into pieces to act as the spacers. So you're on the right track, Joe. Who put you onto ladder line? And sounds to me like you've already got an application involved, but I bet you're a little bit surprised to find there's nothing magic about the exact spacing and 600 ohms. It's just a popular number. Twinly, that used to be used for television antenna reception, was 300 ohms because it's a convenient spacing for that size of cable. And at one time, for the guys on 432, and I was one of them, let me drop. The lowest loss, inexpensive transmission line I could buy was 300 ohm television twin lead, and that's what I used for my Yagis in the beginning, in the mid 70s, for 432 megacycles. Then they also had the ITT company came out with a transmitting kind of twin lead that ran 200 ohms. People have used Zipcord for transmission line on HF frequencies, yes. On UHF frequencies, the rubber in the zip cord is relatively lossy material, so you wouldn't want to use very many feet of it. What you're slowly finding out, Joe, is that the word transmission line, methods of connecting a transmitter to a remote antenna, the kinds of transmission lines that exist in the world, boy, there are, I know of at least 15 kinds of transmission lines. Strip line, microstrip, fin line, waveguide, single fin waveguide, double fin waveguide, open wire line, coax cable where the outer conductor is square, round, triangle, the center conductor is square, round, triangle, and the center conductor doesn't have to have the same shape as the outer conductor. The center conductor doesn't have to be exactly in the middle. So there's probably 15 kinds of transmission line. An open wire line is one of the very low, it's probably one of the very low loss ones, with the exception of certain kinds of waveguide. But at HF frequencies, we don't use waveguide for a whole bunch of reasons. Yeah, I'll probably have some further questions, and let us know how this project is going. Check back with us in a week or two, Joe, and let us know what you've discovered so far. WB2HRO, K2LIW in the TechNet. You've got it, Joe.
We have it before he gets his waste.
Go ahead, Hal.
On the say that method I told for checking out lateral line can be used for finding out if you're not sure of a piece of coax what the impedance is. Also, if you want to run a long distance, which I've done, like Dick did, I don't know if he did it the same way I did, I had to run 200 feet of line to an antenna system. A special 300 ohm cable, just with me. I put a quarter one coaxial little valve. And it's back to 75 ohms on each side and went down the road. Go ahead, Dick.
Mr. IXP recognized. Get to you in a second, sir. The transmission line you use between the shack and the antenna, between the transmitter and the antenna, everyone thinks it's got to be one single piece of constant impedance transmission line with no intermediate connectors and whatever. Lots of people believe that. There's nothing stopping you if you're smart enough. Starting off with a 50 ohm line coming out of the shack, going through the wall, with the right kind of a balance, it transitions over the 600 ohm open wire line. The 600 ohm open wire line takes the major distance up the tower. At the top of the tower, you convert with the right kind of a balancing device from 600 ohm line down to 75 ohm coax, because your antenna just happens to have a 75 ohm input connector. And that could be an extremely high performance transmission line system, as long as you know what you're doing along the way. And even in that piece of 75 ohm transmission line, you might have a bullet or a barrel, in other words, intermediate connectors, taking two particular pieces of cable together. Lots of people think each individual connector you put in the middle of a transmission line creates insertion loss. Absolutely not. As long as it's of reasonable construction, reasonable manufacture, the only way you get insertion loss of a transmission line is with length. A coaxial connector, for instance, has very little length, therefore it has very little ability to make insertion loss of any significant amount. That's another thing that lots of people misunderstand that one. Mr. IXP, give us your full call and name, sir. I know you've checked in before, but I'm very forgetful. K2RIW. IXP, you got it. K2RIW listening.
Kilo Delta 2, India X-ray Papa. Name is John. And yes, I have a question.
Very fine, John. You're on the list. You're right after Ed. Right now we're handling Joe. So we're going to finish with Joe first, go to Ed, and then John in that order. So, Joe, do you have any further questions? And please come back and let us know how your project is proceeding. Transmission lines are fun. Before transmission lines became popular, people didn't think there was any good way in the 1900s, 1910s, to get a transmission signal from the antenna, from the transmitter to the antenna. So the ham radio operator would be operating from the attic of the house, a wooden house, and he was running, let's say, an 80-meter dipole, which is a pair of wires 67 feet long. One wire went out the eastern window, one wire went out the western window of the attic, and on the wooden table in the middle sat the transmitter with no transmission line in between. And that was a very effective system. Well, eventually the ham radio operators wanted to operate from down at lower levels in the house, and yet they wanted the antenna up high. So in between the two, along comes transmission line. I think it was during World War II the coaxial cable became very popular. Before that, open wire line was the major kind of transmission line. WB2, HRO, K2RIW, you got it, Joe.
Dick, one thing before I let him go.
Go ahead, Al.
Mentioned that a balun could be a half-wave piece of coax. You wrap it back up to itself and makes a 4-to-1 conversion device.
Agreed. If you started off with a 75-ohm transmission line and you made a loop of wire coax cable, one half-wave length long, including the velocity factor, and you loop it back on itself so that the shields of the input end and the output end get connected together, the shield of the input transmission line gets connected together, the center conductor of the input transmission line goes to one side of the half-wave loop of coax cable. Now, those two center conductors on the half-wave coax cable, that's the output. That is a half-wave coax balun, and no matter what impedance you use of transmission line, it gives you a 4-to-1 step-up impedance. If you use 75 ohm line, for instance, step up would be 300 ohms. If you use 50 ohm line, 4-to-1 step up would be 200 ohms. And so it's not going to get you all the way to 600 ohms to be a good impedance match. However, if you use that to get to 300 ohms and your open wire line was 600 because you chose that particular spacing, that's only a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Open wire line is so forgiving to transmission to a standing wave ratio, that would be a very effective system. Or conversely, you can decide to build a coax balun with this 4-to-1 impedance step up where you go to 300 ohms, and therefore you decide to set the spacing of your open wire ladder line in order to be 300 ohms. You've got lots and lots of options here, as you can see, Joe. WB2HRO, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Hi. Hold on a second. Well, let me get that call.
Hello?
They hung up on me. That works fine if you're going to stay on one band or one frequency. It won't work if you're trying to build a multi-band and system. And pass it on to the next guy, and I'll get it on the next time around, because I think there's a long-distance call coming in.
Yeah, you can buy commercial 4-to-1 balans that cover much wider frequency range than the half-wave coax balun. Okay, we're going to go over to Ed next. KC2PYT, K2LAW. I've missed seeing you for the last couple of Fridays, Ed. I got a couple of great physics puzzles for you the next time we see each other face-to-face. KC2PYT, K2LAW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2PYT. Can you hear me okay?
You sound real good, Ed. Go right ahead.
Okay, so this is actually a question that I've asked you before in another channel that I've been chewing on and I still don't quite understand. It has to do with half-wave end-fed dipoles and their impedances. Now, you've mentioned many times in the TechNet that 1,500 ohms is roughly a good comment for the impedance of an end-fed dipole, and if you can match your fuse line to that 1,500 ohms, you've got no trouble. What I don't understand yet, and what I would like to understand, is where does that number come from? Because as I understand it, the feed point impedance has to do with the ratio of the current through that antenna to the voltage at that point at that antenna. And if this is a proper half-wave dipole, at the very end of that dipole, where the feed point is, the current whether the current is at a maximum or a minimum, but either way, one is a zero and the other is at a maximum. And so you should have a number that's not 1,500, and I just don't understand where that number comes from.
Take it, Dick. I'm not going to explain the whole thing.
Now, when it comes to a half-wave dipole resonance structure, almost every half-wave dipole that's the right electrical length has a Q of at least 10, if not higher. That means energy is going to bounce back and forth in there 10 times before it finally gets radiated. The word resonance is extremely important. In other words, you're going to set the electrical length just right so that it is resonant. Resonant means that as the signal bounces back and forth 10 times, each of those bounces stay coherent, in step with each other. Make it a little bit too long, and the signal bouncing back and forth starts lagging in phase, and we call that an inductive impedance. Make it a little bit too short. The signal bouncing back and forth gets there too soon. It's leading in phase, and we call that capacitive reactance. So the reactance is really coming from the degree of non-resonance. And you can see, because a dipole is a resonant structure with a Q of 10 or higher, it's like a flywheel. You can decide to put energy into a flywheel any way you want. You can put the push rod very close to the pivot in the center, halfway between the center and the perimeter, or right at the perimeter. You put the push rod at the perimeter, you've got a very high impedance flywheel. Put it near the pivot point, you get a very low impedance flywheel. And so in the same case with a half-wave dipole, let me drop for a whole bunch of absolutely nothing magic about the center. You can feed it at the center. 10% off to one side, 30%, 50%, 75%, 100% off to one side. You get different impedances. You get different balancing requirements when you do that, but you can feed the energy in there any place you want to. So you're feeding energy into a resonant structure. With the simplistic diagrams, you know that the current is maximum in the center and the voltage is near zero at the center. Never is zero, but it's near zero. At the tips of the dipole, the voltage is maximum and the current is near zero. Never exactly zero. And by the way, a so-called half-wave resonant dipole, electronically resonant, is never exactly a half wavelength long. It's about 95% of that length. Because the end capacitance, you've usually got a loop of wire at the end where you put the egg insulator. Let me drop. So you've got a loop of wire and an egg insulator at the end, which is an end loading capacitance. That's one of the factors as to why you make the wire of your dipole roughly 95% of half wavelength long. Call it velocity factor, but that's not really what it is. It's end loading capacitance. And even if you had some magic way of supporting your half wave dipole, so there is no loop at the end. The way field lines couple around a metallic structure that has voltage on it, AC or DC voltage, the way the field lines lie is such that you always get a concentration of field lines near the tip. You're getting end-loading capacitance even though your eye doesn't see it, even though it's just a straight, flat piece of wire, you know, abruptly ending piece of wire at the end. But there is end-loading capacitance. So that's part of the reason why it is less than exactly a half wavelength long. That's why the current end is more than zero. The voltage is maximum. And by the way, because the Q is 10, that really means that somewhere in the structure, the current is 10 times higher than the current that you launched. Somewhere in the structure, the voltage is 10 times higher. There's about 6 different definitions of Q. Voltage rise at resonance. Current rise at resonance. Energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. Rate of change of phase versus frequency. Rise time and fall time. Ring down time. And that's also these 5 or 6 different definitions look like 5 or 6 different phenomena. It's all the exact same resonant flywheel-like phenomena, just 5 or 6 different ways of looking at it and 5 to 6 different ways of measuring it. Let me drop. Now, modeling a dipole, if you really want to get down to the nitty-gritty and really model it, there's a little bit more to it than first meets the eye. And there are various computer modeling programs that attempt to do that, and in many cases they do a pretty good job. But if you're building an elaborate antenna, like say for instance a 10-element Yagi, and you've modeled all the elements, all the parasitic elements and the driven element and the reflector and everything else of that Yagi, you get a pretty good design. But after you've done that finished modeling, you're then going to still do some post-computer optimization, PCO. You're going to do a little bit of tweaking in order to get that last little bit of performance. A good ham radio operator is an extremely good tweaker. The world's best tweaker is a pair of guys, roughly 1946, working for, I think, Bell Laboratories, and Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward said, modeling this stuff is very difficult. Let's really make the measurements. He starts off with a very large sheet of metal. He decides that a dipole is really a pair of monopoles back to back. So, for simplistic reasons, he measures the monopole. So he's got a very large sheet of metal, and he puts a vertical piece of wire in the middle of it with a connector, and he measures the impedance. He sweeps it in frequency, and with slotted line and slide rule and a whole lot of calculations, he measures the real impedance, the resistive component and the reactive component. And he did it for all reasonable lengths of wire. Let me drop. All reasonable lengths of wire. All reasonable diameters of wire. When it comes to getting the exact impedance of a dipole, the diameter of the dipole makes a significant difference, particularly as you start getting either end of the spectrum, either very wide dipoles, like an eighth of a wavelength in diameter, or very skinny dipoles, like a 5/1000th of a diameter. When when you and I build a 80-meter dipole, 131 feet long, at a 14-gauge household wire, the ratio of diameter to length is something like 5,000 to 1. You go to the Brown and Woodward curves, which, by the way, are on Mike number 2's website. That's the one that's called the LimarkTechNet.com. And you look at the Brown and Woodward curves, and you'll see that for your particular diameter of wire, for your particular length of wire, one graph will tell you exactly what the resistive component is going to be. The other graph will tell you exactly what the reactive component is going to be. So you can start off with your wire a quarter wavelength long, which is an ordinary monopole. Make it longer and longer. Make it a half wavelength long. You're now feeding one end of a half wavelength of wire. You look at the Brown and Woodward curve, and you'll find that the impedance is in the resistive component is in the vicinity of 1,500 ohms, 2,000 ohms. And by going to that website, Berkeley, you Google the word Berkeley impedance match, and you'll look at this beautiful website where you give it the frequencies and you give it the impedances, and it tells you exactly how to set up an inductor and a capacitor in order to give you a perfect impedance step up from your 50-ohm coax to the 1,500 ohms of your antenna. And feeding the open end of a half-wave dipole is very desirable, particularly for a field operation, because with your slingshot, let me drop it. With your slingshot, you take your half wavelength of wire and you shoot it up into the tree with your slingshot, and the bottom end of the wire comes down to the ground. You've got your 1,500 ohm impedance matching device, your grounding rod at that point, going over to your coax cable, going over to the transmitter. When you're feeding the open end of a half wave dipole, and you're feeding something like 1,500 ohms, the quality of the ground rod you put in only has to be low compared to 1,500 ohms. If your local ground impedance was 15 ohms, you're going to have extremely high performance. You just put one single grounding rod in there, and you don't need a whole bunch of ground plane radials. If you are feeding a quarter wave vertical ground plane antenna, by comparison, where the input impedance is 35 ohms, and if you don't have a whole bunch of ground plane radials, you just got that one stake in the ground, it's got 15 ohms of resistance, even on real good soil, a significant amount of your power is going into the soil and not being radiated because of that that impedance ratio, if you know what I mean. You can get away with murder when you're feeding the open end. It's something that's very unpopular. Everyone thinks that matching 1,500 ohms is very difficult. I will admit that a direct match by way of an antenna tuner is essentially out of the question. Very few antenna tuners across all of the bands you care about are going to give you a good impedance match to a 1,500 ohm antenna. That's the equivalent of what, a 30 to 1 standing wave ratio or something like that. The average antenna tuner cannot handle something that big. Let me drop. But with a simple inductor and a capacitor as an impedance step-up device, an L network, it's in one step with homebrew wound coil and a soda bottle, if you know what I mean, and the capacitor can even be homebrew. The right way to do it is with a transmitting-grade capacitor, but it's all calculatable ahead of time. So part of what's going on here is that you read the appropriate chapter of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. They give you this great, big, fancy formula, which tries to tell you what is the impedance of a dipole of various diameters and various lengths. And you study that formula. People think that that is a derived formula. Absolutely not. It is a curve-fitting formula. It is a curve-fitting formula for one little section of the Brown and Woodward curves of real measurements. What's really going on at the microscopic level of your dipole is something you and I could write a doctoral thesis on, and there's a lot more to be learned there. So Mother Nature has set it up in such a way that the open end of a half-wave dipole is in the vicinity of 1,500 ohms for your particular diameter of radiator. Use a thicker radiator. You make that radiator thick enough, and the 1,500 ohms will come down to 400 ohms. Make it skinny enough, and the 1,500 ohms will go up to 5,000 ohms. Just for the average way you set up a half-wave dipole, that output impedance is in the vicinity of 1,500 ohms. This is only some of the information, but maybe that's part of what you're looking for, Ed. KC2PYT, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2PYT. Okay, I think we're definitely getting there. So as I understand what you've told me so far, the dipole has, at its two ends, effectively a capacitance. And part of that is because the dipole is actually a little bit shorter than the full one-half wavelength that you would expect from a transmission of that particular wavelength. So, okay. That capacitance at the end means that there can actually be a current at the end, because what's happening then would be that electrons are getting shoved to the end of the antenna and jamming up there until the next cycle, and they can go back the other way. So that kind of answers, as you know, to at least a first order approximation, my original question of how can we have even a real, not just a, you know, finite, but a, you know, any kind of meaningful answer to what the impedance is. Because if the voltage is finite and the current is zero, which it would be if this were strictly a half wave, you'd have an infinite input impedance. So because of that capacitance, it sounds like you actually do have current that is effectively happening even at the very end of the dipole. Is that accurate?
It's 90% accurate, Ed. What's really going on at the molecular level of a dipole is a hell of a lot more action at the molecular level, at the subatomic level, than first meets the eye. One of my favorite puzzles is to ask somebody if you could slow down the time and you would watch a radio wave travel down your transmission line, you watch it go onto your dipole, and then you watch that wave travel down the dipole. So it's a slow motion movie, and by some magic your eyes can see the energy of that RF wave going down the dipole, what you would see. And you'd be amazed how complicated the answer to that is. So by way of the oversimplification we're using here, yes, what you and I have just said is probably 90% accurate, but there is more to it. By the way, whenever we talk about true half wave, that's a so-called free space half wave. In a vacuum, you take 2.99792457878 exponential 8, in other words, that's the number of meters per second in free space that a radio wave or any other electronic wave travels. Divided by frequency, now you know the free space wavelength. Well, on your and my piece of wire down here in air, you know, the surface of the Earth, because of end loading capacitance and a whole lot of other factors, our so-called half-wave dipole is usually 95% of a free space half-wave in length. And so end loading capacitance and the way the field lines align is part of the explanation. Diameter to length ratio is part of the explanation. The Brown and Woodward curves is real, measured, accurate data in 1946, and that data is in every single issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, all five editions, in chapter...
Repeater, timeout.
It's in chapter 4 of every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, in plain sight, since 1946. You ask the average antenna engineer any information about where could you measure real impedance of a dipole-like structure, monopole-like structure, resonant-like or non-resonant structure, any length of wire that you're using as a radiator, like even a straight, even a piece of paper clip. I know a guy who took a piece of paper clip and bent it up just right and stuck it into the end of his rig, and it worked like a charm. And he could then start asking the question, what is the real impedance of that? You go to the Brown and Woodward curve, and you can find the exact number, because those guys in 1946 really measured that exact situation. You try to calculate that by computer modeling, and you come up with an answer. You can get a hell of a lot better answer by going to the horse's mouth, the guy who really made the measurement. So, simple, there's no more simple antenna in the world than a dipole or a monopole. What's really going on in there is a lot more than meets the eye, and that so-called formula that people use to model a dipole, and they make the mistake of assuming it's good for DC to light. You read the caveats that go along with that article for that computer modeling program, for that equation, and it tells you only in the very near vicinity of resonance does this formula hold. And you can find zillions of people who have taken that formula, ignore those caveats, use the formula for DC to light, try to make predictions as to what the off-resonant impedance of a dipole is going to be. They come up with answers that are about 30% accurate, 70% in error, and they wonder what the hell's going on. Well, a dipole is because it's a resonant structure, because...
Repeater, time out.
We radio amateurs, we think we are experts at taking a transmitter and transmitting a signal. Because we do it day in and day out, we assume transmission is easy. Transmission is hard. That signal going down your dipole bounces back and forth 10 times before it finally radiates into space. 5% of it goes into space on each half-wave bounce, if you know what I mean. In other words, to get a signal to jump off of your dipole and to go into free space, you've got to kick that signal in the tail 10 times in a row before it finally happens. You have to use resonance of the structure. In other words, your dipole, the balun, the coax cable, the final stage of your transmitter, that combination, that radiating system, must hit resonance if you want to radiate by the percentages of efficiencies that we amateurs usually talk about and desire. Resonate first, then you can radiate. Once you realize you must resonate, you're kicking that signal in the tail 10 times in a row before it finally leaves. The energy of the signal gets radiated into space. Not one single electron leaves your antenna. Ain't that crazy? So as you can see, there's a lot more to it than first meets the eye, Ed. KC2PYT. Good question. K2LIW in the TechNet. We haven't got the whole answer, but we're getting closer.
K22PYT. Alright, that's plenty for me to chew on for tonight. Thank you very much, and I'll look forward to getting those physics questions or brain teasers next time I see you. K2RW in the TechNet. This is K22PYT.
Ed, what are you using for an antenna and what are you using for a transmitter right now? You sound good, but there is some hiss in the background. Your signal is not quite as strong as you would like it to be. So, what are you using for an antenna? How many watts? And I think your house is like 30 miles from the repeater. Over to you, Ed.
Well, this is actually the problem station that I was talking to you about the other day with the quarter-wave monopole made out of 12-gauge wire and an SO239 connector from Radio Shack mounted on my closet door inside my apartment. So I'm putting out, I don't know, probably 30 or 50 watts. I forget exactly what I set it to. But for tonight, it seems to be transmitting quite well.
Yeah, you and I have made the discussion about taking a handy talkie or any kind of other antenna that's movable, even by taking your SO239 antenna and untaping it from the closet door and walking around the room with it. You will discover when you're listening to a slightly weak repeater that there are certain places in the room where you hear more signal, less signal. When you translate the antenna in X, Y, and Z translation, and you rotate it around the X, Y, and Z axis, you'll find there's all kinds of hot spots and cold spots in your particular environment for reception. And then with a further experiment, you'll find out there's some other slightly different hot spots and cold spots for transmissions. So I think we've had a couple of minor discussions on this one, Ed. When you get a chance to run that experiment, I think you're going to see an eye-opener. Over to Ed first on that one, and then I'll go over to Eric after that. KC2PYT, K2LIW. Get a chance, run that experiment, Ed. Go ahead.
I had a question.
That was actually on the plan for today, and then I got on the repeater and found out that people could hear me and decided not to test my luck. But yeah, I guarantee that will happen again next time I nudge the closet door and the antenna moves.
Understand. Wes, go right ahead with your room.
Dick?
Wes has been signing in quite a few times here trying to get...
I just want to tell you that his signal is not weak into the repeater.
Maybe about a dB and a half weaker than you are getting into the repeater. His problem is he's making noise in his audio as you're taking his noise.
Okay. So you think his transmitter has noise in the audio? Here's the amount of noise I'm making. And I can make the noise a little bit less by changing power. Okay, go ahead with your question, Wes. On this particular subject, N2XJM, K2LAW.
Yeah, I got confused when you gave the explanation. Half a wavelength dipole, 1500 ohms of resistive component. But a resistance of 1/100 of the millimeter of 100 meter is 2,136 ohms. So I'm confused with the numbers that you gave me. Enter your shift.
The real experience of real measurements in a real laboratory done by Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward at a whole lot of different frequencies for a whole lot of different lengths of wire for a whole lot of different diameters of wire for reasonable diameter to length ratios of wire, they always measure something like 1,500 ohms impedance when the piece of wire is approximately a half wavelength long electronically. Electronically, halfway, 95% of a half wave, for instance, you will always measure something in the vicinity of half wavelength long. Whether you're doing it at X band and the piece of wire is a half inch long because there's a 1-inch wavelength at X band, or whether you're doing it at 80 meters and the wire is 131 feet long for half wavelength. In all cases, that length of wire at that half wave resonant frequency will always give you that number of ohms. That's what Mr. Brown and Woodward measured. Real life, horse's mouth, real measurement, real hardware, real laboratory, slotted lines, and slide rule, if you know what I mean. You can come up with all kinds of theories as to what you think the resistive component is going to be. That is what it is. You can deny it exists if you want to. It's only been there in plain sight since 1946. You either accept it or fight it. It's real. Now you and I have to come up with an explanation that easily fits our mind as to why that's what it really is.
And so why it is?
WB2HRO?
WB2HRO. Go ahead, Joe.
Antenna you describe, half wavelength of wire, and shooting it over a tree. Where's the far end of the wire? Is it open or is that tied to the ground also? I understand the stake in the ground is one side of the line of the coax, the other is going up the, but is it, it's both ends going into the far end grounded or is it open-ended?
You didn't finish the answer. Why do you think it is this way?
I don't know. Joe, the open end, it's a half-wave vertical antenna in the ideal world. You're going to shoot your piece of wire up in the air, vertically polarized. The bottom end is where you put the loading coil for 1,500 ohms and beep to match, and the stake going over to your coax cable, going over to your transmitter. The other end is straight up in the air, in the tree, unterminated. There's nothing magic about it being purely vertical. You can tilt it over at a 30-degree angle, 60-degree angle. You can make it an end-fed ZEP where it's parallel to the ground, almost like a beverage antenna. Lay it out any way you want. So there's nothing magic about being purely vertical. Just that you're going to have the highest highest altitude of radiation if it's a pure vertical piece of wire. Therefore, you're going to get the highest performance if your tree is tall enough to do it that way. Does that make some sense, Joe? WB2HRO, K2IW.
WB2HRO, I understand now. I'm using a half-wave width right now, a GAM antenna. It's half-wave stainless steel rod, and there's a coil at the bottom, and somehow the coax works right into that, and it's so it's similar to what you're talking about, only this is 2 meters, okay? Right back to you, I understand.
Yeah, that coil at the bottom is the impedance matching device that's stepping up the 50 ohms of the coax cable going into your antenna to the approximately 1,500 ohms at the base of your whip. However, many vertical antennas claim to be half-wave. They're in that vicinity. In some cases, they're 5/8 wave. In some cases, they're half-wave. In some cases, they're 90% of a half-wave, and so on. And therefore, there's going to be a little bit of inductance or capacitance left over, and the coil with the right kind of a capacitor across it will tune that out and give you that step up of 1,500 ohms. So the exact half wavelength it's a convenient number. Exact electronic half wavelength is a convenient number. There's nothing magic about that number. As long as your antenna radiating system is resonant, you resonate first, it will radiate. So as long as your balun, impedance matching device, the radiator, the transmission line, the final stage of the coax, of the transmitter, the antenna tuner, if there is one, as long as that system hits resonance, when it's all tuned up just right, you'll radiate like a banshee. You'll radiate to 90-some-odd% efficiency, if you know what I mean. Those magic words, resonate first, then it will radiate. I know of no good, respected antenna book that says those words. I'm amazed. It's the most basic piece of information required to make a radiating system, to make a real antenna. And they got all kinds of fancy formulas and fancy Maxwell's equations, methods of trying to explain what's going on. Where the rubber meets the road is the system must radiate. Now, it must resonate in order to radiate by amateur standards. And let me give you a little bit of a correction on this one. If I was an electromagnetic compatibility engineer doing a test to a mil standard on a piece of electronics that's in a box, and if that mil standard says that all undesired signals radiating from that box, all undesired signals are going to be 60 decibels weaker than the desirable signal, that's a specification. And so I've got a little bit of an edge of the box that's not properly soldered together. There's a missing screw, and some signals come squirting out of there. And the signal comes squirting out of there is 48 dB down instead of 60 dB down. It fails the spec by 12 dB. That electromagnetic engineer will say, hey, that box is radiating. 48 dB down. That's a 1 millionth, a little bit more than a couple of steps of a millionth of the amount of power running around in that box and coming out as a desirable signal. Something like 1 millionth of it is squirting out at the wrong frequency because of the edge of the box. He called that radiation. In his vocabulary, it fails the spec, and yes, the box is radiating. No self-respecting ham radio would call that radiation. Your and my definition of radiation is I put 100 watts into the antenna, and I want 97 of those watts radiated into space. I want very little of it wasted as current flowing into the resistance of the grounding system, of the transmission line, of the resistance of the wire of the antenna, and so on. I want 90-some-odd percent of my power in going into signal, going across that ionosphere, and going into that receiving antenna of the guy on the other side, and moving the signal's transmitter and coming out of his loudspeaker. That's what I call radiation. So for that definition of radiation, you must resonate first. And as I said, I have not found any respected textbook on antenna engineering that says those words. Craziness.
Repeater, time out.
So we amateurs are teaching each other the real secret of radiation from my point of view. Okay, John was the next guy with a question. KD2, India X-ray Papa, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Dick. Good evening, gentlemen. I hope you can hear me. I seem to be having some trouble getting out in the last couple of days. There's all this white stuff over my house and the neighborhood, and this may be interfering. And that's got a large part to do with my question. Before, when I was hitting the Glen Oaks repeater, I didn't have this kind of